You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.
How money make you lost the true love in where you had? Say money make you rich, how money make you poor? How money make you buy us and can't go through the door? Them love the money, they still want the money. They love the money, they still want the money. Them love the money, they still want the money. They love the money, they still want the money.
Lines on 93.5 Unity FM, and you just heard those two little voiceovers there. 8:30, 15th of March 2011, today Tuesday. You are absolutely listening Behind the Headlines with myself, Saeed Ahmed and Tariq Ziad. Very interesting first half hour. We've been discussing the Sunday Mercury article regarding this 3-year-old child who's been treated at one of Birmingham's NHS Trust hospitals with an alcohol addiction. It was said to be that he was the youngest alcoholic in Britain.
Well, I've certainly never heard of anyone as young as that.
Well, nor have I, Tariq, and to be honest with you...
I was kind of rubbing my eyes and just checking my ears when I actually first heard this, you know.
It's something quite incredible.
It is
incredible.
Quite a while back, you know, I remember actually there's a paper called The Metro we get here in Birmingham, which is a free paper, which is used on the buses in the morning.
Yes.
And it featured a similar article of a very, very young child, approximately maybe 3-4 years old, who was smoking cigarettes.
Yes, I was told about this this little piece as well. He apparently 2 packets of cigarettes.
Well, I don't know exactly how much, but it was actually, he was found to be smoking cigarettes, and I think it was actually the social services removed that child, you know, from their parents. So I don't know the exact story, but it's shocking to hear that children as young as that are getting access to things which are clearly...
Tobacco and alcohol. It makes you feel, doesn't it?
They're not suitable for children of that age, certainly.
Well, no, I mean, smoking, it's not all, alcohol is not suitable for anyone at any age, so to speak. But anyway, as you may have heard, the sad events of Friday, Japan, of course, is in our thoughts. You've seen the pictures on many, many of your papers.
And today's show is dedicated to people of Japan.
Absolutely.
We ask our listeners to dedicate and to donate to whichever cause you wish to donate to. But, you know, please give in this cause. It's a very, very important thing. People are going through a terrible time right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, in these times of trouble, you know, Tariq, you know, we should stand by their side, if not in physical form, in spiritual form.
Indeed.
Well, anyway, moving on. Joining us from BCFM, Bristol Community Radio, is Martin Summers. Good evening, Martin. Good evening, Martin.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can now, yes. Right. Well, it's nice. It was nice to see you last week in the flesh, so to speak.
It was great to see you lot as well.
And they were a fantastic show. Martin, a lot of developments in the Middle East and around the world.
Yeah, I think what I would like to focus on this evening in my little segment here is the interaction between the earthquake in Japan, the uprisings in the Middle East, and the world economy. Because the world economy, frankly, is right on the brink as we speak. Right on the brink. I studied political economy. And political economy is not just about mathematical puzzles. It's actually because actually the politics impacts in the real world. The politics impacts on the economic substructure. So all of the uncertainty about what's happened with the Saudi military going into Bahrain has created all sorts of uncertainty in the markets. And of course, the earthquake in Japan and the nuclear crisis has knocked their stock market off by 10%. And all of this is demonstrating what I believe, which is that politics and economics are linked together. And one of the reasons why we're in this crisis is partly to do with selfish, greedy behavior, but it's also to do with an intellectual failure. The people behind designing these very super clever mathematical derivatives, which are at the heart of the problem, they treat the economy as if it's a mathematical puzzle. And all they've got to do is be clever enough to figure it out. The real world isn't like that. The real world is much more complicated than that. And underlying the writing of derivatives is something called the Black-Scholes theorem, which was developed by 2 Nobel Prize-winning economists. Myron Scholes was one of them. And they basically thought that they'd come in. It's like people who bet on horses who think that they've got a system. Yeah? They've got a system, and they think they're going to win.
Yes.
But anybody who tries to work a system betting on horses, and I've got some friends who are quite keen on betting on horses, they all think they've got a system, and they never win because it's not predictable. And it's actually not predictable in principle. There's a mathematician called Mandelbrot, who's died not long ago, and he discovered fractals. And fractals are the basis of chaos theory. And what a fractal mathematical flow is something like a waterfall or something like that. It's predictable in a general sort of way, but the actual prediction of which bit of water will fall where is not predictable even in principle. Even if you have the biggest, cleverest computer you can possibly imagine, a fractal field is not predictable. And Black-Scholes theorem is based on the kind of math that's done by differential equations, and it's based on the idea that in big numbers things do become predictable. But what Mandelbrot pointed out is that that these things are in principle unpredictable, and that's why, of course, you have to have checks, balances. You know, you can't just let the market decide, because the market doesn't know what it wants. The market will just come up with any kind of random possibility. You've got to rein it in with some kind of planning and control, otherwise it just can potentially go off in a completely random direction that you can't control. And that's exactly what is happening. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what is happening. They've created a Frankenstein's monster, and they now don't know how to switch it off. And I was thinking in relation to this, in relation to Islamic ideas about finance and banking. And I don't know if your listeners will have heard of this. Many of may have heard of it. The Grameen Bank in Bangladesh.
No, I haven't, sir. Could you tell us more?
The Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. All right, well, let me just tell you about that. That was founded by a financier called Muhammad Yunus. He was basically a top-flight banker, and he could see that all these poor people in Bangladesh, you know, they just couldn't get credit. And he realised that with small amounts of credit, poor people could actually really massively improve their lives. But it's very difficult for poor people to get any credit because they've got no collateral. You know, they've got nothing to offer. And most people will never lend money to people without collateral. So the Grameen Bank was set up to lend to the poorest people. And the system, based on Islamic social values, was that it's mostly women are the borrowers. Not always, but mostly. And if you want to borrow from the Grameen Bank, you have to get a group of five of you to go forward with five different ideas. And then by lot, one person is chosen to go first, and their idea goes first, and they're allowed to borrow money for their idea. But all the other four people stand surety for the first person, yeah? So that everybody covers everybody else's debts. And it's worked fantastically well over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yes.
And in actual fact, poor people are the kind of people who do pay their debts. It's wealthy people who walk away from their debts. Poor people are actually very punctilious about paying what they owe. But of course, administering these loans is very expensive. That's why big banks don't do it, because you know you have to check everything very closely. It's much easier to just lend you know $1 billion to Saudi Arabia, and then you know it's just one piece of paper, as it were. But Muhammad Yunus, who founded the bank, has recently been accused of being having his fingers in the till, and he's been removed from it. He won a Nobel Prize or something for it, I think.
I knew that he'd won a Nobel Prize. I knew that much.
I don't think he did win a Nobel Prize. I may be exaggerating there, but he's very well known.
Well, he's won something similar. I definitely know that.
He's very well known, and I think I approve very much of what they've done there. But one of the problems is that the people have leaped onto this from the outside and said, "Oh, this is the answer to everything. All we've got to do is set everybody up with their own small business, and that will solve the problems." Now, I'm all in favour of people setting up their own businesses, no problem with that at all. But you can't actually ultimately have a big economy with everybody just as their own business, as their own boss. If you look at the economy in Japan, which of course is in a trouble at the moment, I mean, they very consciously planned their way from being a low-wage agricultural economy. They moved into electronics, and then they moved from electronics into even more high-tech, and that was all planned. You know, they didn't just leave it to chance. And, of course, that's the future, the positive future for countries like Bangladesh, if they can do it properly. I mean, they've got some industry in Bangladesh, you know, textile industry. You don't want to lose that. And this, of course, we're coming back to the old idea of a balance. We want a market. I mean, Islam explicitly encourages people to trade. And the Prophet, peace be upon him, was a trader. But at the same time, that's got to be within a moral framework. It's not just take everything and to hell with everybody else, is it?
It's not, Martin, you're absolutely right.
And I think that, you see, this is the moment for people to look at these ideas again and have a good think about them. Because, in Islam, as you know, interest is forbidden. There is a rational reason for interest, which is that I wouldn't lend you money unless I'm going to get something for it. I mean, it's like asking everybody to love everybody as much as they love their own family. It's just not realistic. But on the other hand, usury in my book is when you charge more for that service than you really ought to. And that's been a huge problem for many generations. Those with money ought to lend it out at a reasonable rate, but of course it's in their interest not to do that. And the whole finance, insurance and real estate sector has basically eaten up the rest of the economy. And what's now happening is that the financial sector, like some kind of cancerous growth, is basically cannibalizing the rest of the economy. And frankly, we used to know that this was a danger. It's not as if this is unpredicted. But we've had a generation, in my view, I mean, I'm old enough to remember, we've had a generation of basically wrong thinking. Apart from the greed, of course, which of course, what's underpinned all of this is the self-interest of those at the heart of it. So I think we're at last people are beginning to realise that there is a role for society at large to make an overall plan of what we're, where we want to go. It can't just be left to chance. And in, even in the United States, I don't know if people have seen, there's been a huge, they tried to take away all of the bargaining rights from the teachers and the firefighters and other public sector workers in Wisconsin, in the north of the United States. And the teachers and the firefighters already agreed a pay cut. They'd already agreed a reduction in their pension payments. But they said, you can't take away our right to collectively bargain with you. You know, that's that, you know, you're saying that you won't talk to us anymore, but we're going to go on strike. And they have been on strike. And there have been thousands of people in the snow occupying the Capitol building in Madison. It's the biggest rebellion by working class people in America for a generation. And of course, it's gone down the, in more normal times, this would be top news everywhere. But of course, we've got all this other stuff going on. And what's happening is there's so much going on that lots of struggles and fights around the planet are not really getting the coverage that they deserve at the moment because there's too many other big things happening. I mean, the biggest thing that's going to be happening in this country, I imagine, is going to be this demonstration on March the 26th, which is a week on Saturday in London. I mean, the police themselves have predicted 1 million people. And that's the police's estimate.
Tell us a little bit more about those demonstrations, Martin, that's going to be taking place on the 26th of March and what it entails.
It's basically to oppose, in other countries in Europe and around the world, and we've seen it in the Arab world, people realise that if you want to change the government's mind, you've got to go into the streets and tell them we're not having it. And they haven't got a mandate for what they're proposing to do. For example, the health service reforms which are being pushed through were not mentioned at all in the run-up to the election. Not at all. If people had known that's what they were going to do, they wouldn't have voted for them. And you're going to see now that in the opinion polls, the coalition is starting to waver. And people all over the world, and we've seen this in Egypt, we've seen it in lots of places, we're seeing it in Madison, Wisconsin, if people don't stand up for themselves, you'll be walked all over. And the only people who fight to defend themselves deserve to be free. And that's always been true.
So you mentioned, Martin, there's quite a lot of developments happening in the world which are not really getting the coverage they should. Is there anything you've noticed over the last week?
We mentioned it last week in relation to Libya, which is it's clearly been said by reputable Middle Eastern journalistic organisations, Press TV, for example, which is reputable, that the Gaddafi is basically being supplied with African mercenaries by an Israeli company called OCT, who had a meeting with the Israeli government to say, was it okay if they supplied Gaddafi with mercenaries? And the mercenaries fighting on his side are being paid something like $100 a day, and Gaddafi is paying $2,000 a day for each one of them, and that money is going to the Israelis. And that's actually out there in the Middle East. People know this. And that's why there's now a split between the British and the French, who want to put in a no-fly zone over Libya, and the Americans, who suddenly got cold feet. And the Americans have got cold feet because the Israelis have said to them, no, actually, we want Gaddafi to win. Back out. And Gaddafi, of course, has always been very ostentatiously anti-Israel in his rhetoric. But one of his sons has got an Israeli girlfriend, apparently, and pops back and forth all the time. And the Israelis regard Gaddafi as a useful idiot. They've always regarded him as a useful idiot.
Well, one of the things that I was reading, Martin...
He shouts off about Israel, but he doesn't do anything, and that's the way they like it.
Yeah, one of the things I was reading, Martin, was that you mentioned one of Gaddafi's sons. One of his sons' name is Saif, and he actually came and gave a speech at the LSC a couple of years back.
Well, I mean, basically, the Libyans were brought into the fold a few years ago after they said that they did Lockerbie. I don't believe they did do Lockerbie, but because they were prepared to take the blame for it, they were then brought back into the fold. And lots of establishment people in the West decided they liked Gaddafi. And don't forget, the Israelis like Gaddafi, so why can't we all like Gaddafi? I tell you, who doesn't like Gaddafi? It's the Libyan people. And I can see that the Libyan National Council are calling for a no-fly zone. I think this is going to be a very hard debate in the anti-war movement in Britain. I mean, when I was an aid worker in Bosnia in the 90s, I'm generally against foreign intervention in anything. But on the other hand, what I was seeing in Bosnia was making me think, well, is the lesser of two evils here for an outside force to come in and do something about what's happening? Because it's totally unacceptable. And I have to admit, I'm still not sure whether I supported that or I didn't support it. My instinct would be to, you know, foreigners should stay out of other people's fights. But then sometimes, very, very, I'm not so closed-minded that I couldn't see that under some circumstances that might be the best solution. And, for example, when the British intervened in Sierra Leone in the 1990s under Tony Blair, I think in general that was a successful intervention. It squashed the civil war, it allowed a democratic election, and that was what I would think of as proportionate and sensible intervention. If you think you can really do some good, you know, you've got to ask yourself, am I going to do any good here? Or is it just going to... I mean, if we put a no-fly zone in on Libya and Gaddafi just wins by running people over with tanks, which, of course, he might do, even with a no-fly zone in place, are we going to stop him running him over with tanks or only with aircraft? And I think that there's all sorts of games being played here, and I can't see everything that's happening. I mean, obviously, I sit on the internet and try and keep up, but there's so much going on, it's very hard to know exactly what's going on.
Indeed, it's a very worrying situation with the whole no-fly zone thing as well.
Well, it is. I mean, I've got an open mind. I mean, my general philosophy would be, if people in a particular community want something and they are asking for it, then maybe I will consider it. But at the same time, there's a lot of resistance to it by people. I mean, Richard Falk, for example, who's the UN rapporteur on human rights in Palestine, he said, look, we've got to get over this idea that we can intervene militarily and solve other people's problems for them. Because perhaps we can't. I mean, even if we mean well, war is a very blunt instrument. Very blunt instrument. No doubt civilians will be killed. I mean, in Afghanistan, which we've mentioned places where people have forgotten about, there's all sorts of murder and mayhem going on in Afghanistan. Karzai's brother has been killed by US Special Forces, and he's complaining about that. And Karzai, there was some children collecting firewood, nine children collecting firewood, were killed by a bomb. And Karzai's come out and said, I want NATO operations in Afghanistan to stop. Just go back to your bases and stay there. Now, as I say, there's so much going on. I mean, this is before we start talking about places like Sri Lanka, which have really dropped out of people's consciousness.
But would you mind saying, though, I mean, you talk about people, civilians being killed, but wouldn't you say that's one of the facts of war? I mean, collateral damage.
Well, I am not a pacifist, but what people have got to realise, I mean, Oxfam pointed this out years ago, in the 20th century, 85% plus of the casualties are civilians in virtually every war you can think of, whether it's a sort of guerrilla war like in Ireland or a big war like Japan versus the US. Most of the people who die are civilians, and that's modern warfare. And that's why war has got to be the absolutely last resort.
But I mean,
we don't want to be rushing hither and yon, starting wars. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, we were talking about Libya at the moment. I mean, yesterday I was watching on a couple of the news channels that the rebels are not able to hold back Gaddafi's forces, and
they haven't got enough heavy weapons.
But do you think? I mean, because they're calling for a no-fly zone. Now the
that seems to be the call. I mean, there's some confusion about that. But, and of course, this is a self-appointed committee. Who are they? I don't know. Do you know? I mean,
no.
I have no idea who they are.
No, but I mean, no-fly zone though. The support they wanted the NATO's backing, Europe and US, but the only two countries that are really, to be honest with you, fighting for the no-fly zone in Europe are Britain and France and the European Union.
The European Union is lukewarm. The Germans, I don't think, are very keen at all. I mean, their instinct is just to stay out of it. France and Britain, of course, have got an imperial history, and they just... I mean, I'm amazed by David Cameron. Even if he wanted to do this, he's not prepared British public opinion, really.
No.
I mean, they did an opinion poll in the United States. He said, do you want us to intervene in Libya? And 90% of people said no. I mean, they're sorry for the people. I mean, don't forget there are lots of other people being repressed around the world at the moment. In Bahrain, for example, or the Congo. I mean, we forget about this. People are dying every day all over the place, but we can't go charging around intervening in everything, can we?
No.
It's just infeasible.
Well, I mean, you talk about Bahrain. I mean, just today it's been reported that Saudi has sent troops to Bahrain.
I think that's very significant. That's very significant.
It is.
The Bahraini opposition has said, right, well, that's it then. This is going to be a fight to the finish. And the Saudi manoeuvre has freaked out the market. So I mean, what everybody's really worried about is dis- disruption of oil supply from Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And every little quake, you saw that after Friday prayers in Saudi Arabia, there was very, very little, well, hardly any protest because there was lockdown. You know, the police were everywhere, the army were everywhere, and people were too scared to go out and demonstrate. And you could say, well, that means that Saudi Arabia's at peace and Libya's at war. What it means is that Saudi Arabia, people are so terrified, they don't even dare to go in the street. That's what that means.
Well, that's not a good situation at all.
No, of course it's not. It's been a mess for years. I mean, Yemen, in the south of Saudi Arabia, is where most of the population in Arabia live. And the imperial powers deliberately created Yemen as a separate bit from Saudi Arabia so that all the oil would be in the hands of a small number of people that they could deal with, the Al Saud family. And it was the Al Saud family were basically put in power by outside forces because they wanted to deal with a few rich people and they didn't want to share the oil with everybody that lived in the region. And that's been the problem all along. And if the West does intervene in Libya, it won't be to help. The real motivation won't be to help the ordinary people. They want to get the oil one way or another.
Well,
if
I mean,
deal with Gaddafi, or they'll deal with somebody else.
Wouldn't it be said it's the same as Saudi? I mean, if we're hell-bent on intervening Libya, what about all the protests that have been locked down in Saudi and now they sent, which is, as you say, a significant development?
It's critical, isn't it? I mean, the Arab League have called for a no-fly zone.
Yes.
Who are the Arab League? Well, the Arab League is King Fahd of Saudi Arabia and the King of Bahrain. And they say, yes, we want you to put a no-fly zone on Libya. What the Americans have said to the Bahrainis, the royal family, is if you promise to reform, you know, say something, we will back you.
Mm.
Well, and that's absurd. I mean, the Bahrain is a civilised, sophisticated society. They're not, as is Libya. They're relatively wealthy societies compared to Egypt. And they could be quite modern countries if the people were allowed to run them. And I can't, you know, but we know that the Americans and the Israelis aren't interested in democracy in the Middle East. They never have been, only if it goes their way.
Well, anyway, I mean, there's been an article on, I think, on a Saturday, that how the Americans actually admitted to unashamedly paying for these uprisings in the Middle East,
Egypt, and
Libya.
I mean, this is all very, very speculative, but I think that the there's an element within the American ruling class that thinks that this will be a good idea to encourage, that there's going to be change anyway. With their logic, this is sort of Zbigniew Brzezinski and people like that. They've said there's going to be change anyway, so well, let's get on the right side of history and let's be, you know, we will provide funds for the people who are trying to change. You know, we'll give them training, we'll give them backing, we'll give them internet access and so on. And that's definitely going on. But that doesn't mean that the ordinary people don't want liberty, because they do. And, you know, you inevitably you're going to accept help from anybody who offers it. But I think this whole strategy of trying to manage change in the Middle East is frustrated by one big fly in the ointment, and that is Israel. Israel wants no change. And their policy was to back Mubarak to the hilt, to back Gaddafi to the hilt. And how many people in this country realise that the Israelis are supplying mercenaries to Gaddafi? But that's what's going on. That's what's happening. And they don't want any change. So they're out of line with the British and the French and the Americans. I mean, basically, everybody's... What happens in a crisis like this, like in the run-up to the First World War, suddenly everybody realises who their real friends are. It's like a kaleidoscope shaking, and a whole new set of alliances begins to develop. But the Israelis are really making... You know, they're not making this any easier. They're, you know, they're awkward neighbours to have.
Martin Summers, do apologise for technical hitch there. We actually run out of time. We're very close to the break now, but we thank you very much for joining us again and keeping us enlightened and keeping us informed as always.
It's a great pleasure to. I enjoyed coming to visit you last week, and it's a great pleasure to be in dialogue with everybody.
Well, the pleasure was all ours. Martin Summers, thank you very much, and do tune in to Martin's show with Tony Gosling every Friday, 5 till 7 p.m. on Bristol City Community FM.
Or Community Radio. Or you can get it off the internet at thisweek.org.
That's right, thisweek.org.uk. Thank you very much, Martin.
Thank you.
Well, we're also very short on time now as well, so that if there's anything you heard that you want to comment on, the number is 0121 772 8892. That's 0121 772 8892. And please do call in and share your views. We'll be glad to listen. Well, you can also go on our Facebook page. That's Facebook Behind the Headlines. You can find that. Put your comments on there. And we've got an email address as well, sorry.
That's Behind the Headlines, 935@hotmail.co.uk.
Back after this.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Community FM.
listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.
Listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.